You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
In the summer of 2010, about 3 months after the overthrow of the Bakiyev government in Bishkek, interethnic violence broke out in southern Kyrgyzstan. After the fact, an independent international commission of inquiry into the events of southern Kyrgyzstan was formed. And I want to just go over a few of their conclusions about the events. They indicated that the violence led to significant loss of life and injury, of which the majority of victims were ethnic Uzbeks. In total, about 470 people died. About 1,900 people received medical assistance at hospitals. Many thousands of people were displaced. There was also significant property damage, again, to a disproportionately high number of ethnic Uzbek-owned properties. The report then goes on to state that if the evidence of some acts committed during certain attacks against the Mahallas in Osh on 11, 12, and 13 June was proven beyond reasonable doubt in a court of law, those acts would amount to crimes against humanity. These are murder, rape, other forms of sexual violence, physical violence, and persecution against an identifiable group on ethnic grounds. Unfortunately, in the aftermath of the violence, the International Commission reported that violations continued. They noted that there have been serious violations of international human rights law committed by the state in the aftermath of the events. There is a consistent and reliable body of material which tends to show that acts of torture were committed in detention centers by the authorities of Kyrgyzstan in the aftermath of the June events. Criminal investigations and trials which have resulted from the June events have been marked by breaches of the ICCPR fair trial right. There have been selective prosecutions targeting ethnic Uzbek minorities. Today in Ukraine, we are seeing a different, but not altogether dissimilar scenario, unfortunately involving many of the same phenomena, including high numbers of people killed. I've seen estimates of over 4,000 now. Very large numbers of people displaced. We're witnessing something a little bit new in history, what many people are now calling a hybrid war, that is part invasion and part civil conflict. And while the conflict in Ukraine is not ethnic, necessarily, as it was in Kyrgyzstan, it does have an element playing on regional tensions in the country, east versus west in Ukraine, just as it was north versus south in Kyrgyzstan. In Kyrgyzstan, once the violence ended, the international community responded by providing a great deal of assistance, some of it humanitarian, but a great deal of it focused on peace building and on efforts to try and reconcile groups there. We're pleased today to be joined by Professor Nick Megrin of Newcastle University, who will be discussing the findings of his study, Peace Building and Reconciliation Projects in Southern Kyrgyzstan. And we're also pleased to be joined remotely by my colleague, Ina Pidluska, who is the Deputy Director of the International Renaissance Foundation in Kyiv. She will discuss the situation in eastern Ukraine and recommendations for what needs to be done to try to rebuild peace and overcome the effects of the conflict today. This event is on the record and is being recorded. So I'll turn it over to Nick then.
Thank you, Jeff, and greetings to Ina and Michael, and also thank you, all of you, for coming. As Jeff has said, the violence in Osh in 2010 was terrible and unprecedented in its scale in Kyrgyzstan. Osh is a city I've been visiting and working on for 20 years. I'm particularly stirred by that tragedy. And what I want to talk about today is the various international responses to it, but I want to talk about the peace building and reconciliation and mediation responses that were made. These make striking claims to success, and in this talk I want to question those claims to success. It is of course difficult to It's difficult to measure how successful programs are that are designed to build tolerance. This is an intangible resource. And it's also difficult to work out how you would assess the ability, the success of programs that are designed to prevent conflict occurring. One wouldn't really know if that not occurred as a result of these programs. So what I want to raise there is not a dogmatic refutation of these programs, but raise some critical questions about them. And the talk is based on a report that OSF and CIPRI commissioned myself and Elmira Sattel-Baldeva and David Lewis and John Hedershaw, who are unable to be here today, commissioned us to write last year. And I want to do four things. Firstly, outline the programs I'm discussing, and then raise some questions about them, then think about how we can evaluate them, and finish with some conclusions and suggestions. So firstly, an outline of the programs I'm talking about. These were, I'm calling them peace building and reconciliation mediation programs. And very soon after the violence, a number of international agencies began implementing them. So for example, USAID spent $10 million between 2011 and 2013, funding over 163 different programs. These included building parks in multi-ethnic areas of OSH to try and promote cooperation. It involved engaging young people, women, and the local state with peace building, and they funded these over 40 multi-ethnic regions across the south of Kyrgyzstan. The EU spent €4.5 million in the same period, working with 7 international and 9 local NGOs. And what these typically did was identify local community leaders, give them reconciliation and peace-building seminars, and then ask them to go on and train others. So the OSCE, for example, claims it trained 750 mediators during this period, and International Alert claimed 700. But why were these adopted so quickly, and why were there so many of these programs? Well, there's a number of reasons. Partially, it's bandwagoning. So I interviewed the person who worked for these organisations. And he described it as this. He said, it seems a bit scary. It seems to me that this is an idea that people think seems to work well in one case, so everyone jumped on it. But more often than not, it is based on misunderstanding and misrecognition. In last June, there was no violence in Uzgen, which is a town in southern Kyrgyzstan. Why was this? There were lots of explanations and theories given, but one was that the mediators stepped in front of the crowds and calmed them down. So the internationals went ballistic, saying, ah yes, if we have these everywhere, the next time they will stop. Another reason for the popularity was that these were inexpensive. They were also, they looked good on spreadsheets. It's easy to claim you trained so many hundred mediators. They worked very well with short-term budgets. A lot of the people we spoke to said, well, we were given this money, we had to spend it by a certain period, so these worked well. And they were also very easy to implement through pre-existing local partners. Many international agencies worked with a small number of local NGOs who have become quite adept at professionally delivering these projects. So that's what I'm talking about. Based on our interviews, which were with, we did about 100 interviews with people who were working for these organisations implementing projects, with people who were trained by these projects. We identify a number of reasons which cause us to call them into question. And one of these is that these projects misdiagnose the causes of conflict. They misdiagnose the causes of conflict. Basically, they see lack of familiarity between ordinary people as a problem, rather than a lack of justice or economic opportunity, or rather, as many of our respondents said, the shenanigans of the elites. So, for example, we interviewed Olimjon, who was the head teacher of an Uzbek school in Osh. He participated in several of these tolerance seminars, and this is what he said to them in the extended quote. He said, "My opinion is that such seminars are useless. I don't understand how these trainers can teach us to be tolerant. In reality, people living in Central Asia are tolerant and have learned this from their parents and grandparents. If these people really want to help, they should stay away from my ideology. I don't need them to tell me how to build my relationship with my colleagues' friends. I had colleagues' friends and I still have them. Look, my assistant is Uzbek and her husband is Kyrgyz. How can they teach us how to live together? These people know better than anybody else. They're just wasting resources. So much money is spent on transportation, on accommodation, and various materials. I think it would be more sensible if they used this money to buy computers and give them to the school. That would make it all happen. And he argued that elites were to blame for causing the violence. Another example, I spent a day taking part in a school in Osh that had a peace-building event between Kyrgyz and Uzbek. Kyrgyz school joined the Uzbek school. Many of the activities involved Uzbek children speaking Kyrgyz, dressing up in Kyrgyz clothes, eating Kyrgyz food, and singing songs about their love for Kyrgyzstan. There was a jolly intercommunal dancing session, which people swapped ethnic hats and danced together. And then the visiting Kyrgyz head teacher gave a speech, a very emotional speech, and she insisted that we would never let the bad events of last year come to us. It would be as if nothing had ever happened. And she ended with a series of wishes that the friendship between us will never be broken. Now, listening to her was a senior teacher in the school I've known for a long time. And she asked me about urban riots in England in 2011, that summer. She'd seen them on the television. And I explained that protests began when the murder of a black teenager by the police occurred in custody, that others used it as an excuse to rob and to loot. And she said, with a bit of sarcasm, yes, they must have talked about Kyrgyz there. A further irony was that standing near us when we were talking were private security guards, which the parents of the children had hired to protect the school and their children from attack by mobs of Kyrgyz criminals and youths who at that time were preying on the Uzbek community with impunity. So fine words about friendship and working alongside each other and wearing each other's hats meant little when ongoing injustices were still being perpetrated. Osh Uzbek repeatedly stressed to me a lack of justice, and especially police and court corruption as the main obstacles to peace. That's the first round we questioned these initiatives, that they misdiagnose the causes of conflict. And the second factor, the second criticism that many people raised to us was the way in which people were recruited to take part in these seminars. There is an emphasis on diversity, that women and the elderly and mixed ages and people from different regions and different ethnic groups should be involved. What actually happens generally is that community leaders are identified, or future leaders, and they're the group who work with them. One of the criticisms that was made is that this fails to deal with the so-called angry young men who perpetrated most of the violence. The main violence against Uzbek neighbourhoods seems to have been committed by young Kyrgyz men who came in from the Alay Mountains. So, for example, Nurbek, who's the mayor of a small town, a Kyrgyz mayor in southern Kyrgyzstan, obviously trying to explain to donors the importance of working with deprived communities and tackling structural inequalities. His concerns were dismissed. He said this: I get tired of trying to explain the real risks of conflict to international organisations. They come and circle the affected areas and search for the sources of conflict there. I told them, you look at the wrong place. Conflict did not originate here. These homes were attacked by the people who lived in the upper zone, mono-ethnic Kyrgyz mountainous areas. Go and search for problems there. Like Norbeck, many state officials in Osh didn't understand the donor's obsession in working with ethnically mixed neighbourhoods. For instance, USAID built 8 parks in what it called targeted multicultural locations in order to create safe spaces to help to build confidence in each other and prevent conflicts. But participants in Osh seminars and we interviewed question the logic of organising reconciliation with urban Kyrgyz residents, when most of their homes were attacked by Kyrgyz who came from external mono-ethnic areas. And Uzbek NGO lawyer in Osh knows, people living in Osh have no complaints with each other. But now they, the donors, are reconciling people who are living in mixed territories. But they have no problems with each other here. They should do peace work in Harakulja and Alay regions, not here. several Uzbeks who spoke to you insisted they didn't have a grudge against their Kurdish neighbours, and they wanted the donors to go and work with rural Kurdish youth. One local head of a residential neighbourhood in Pozeglo of Osh told us, Osh city residents are not guilty. They don't bear a grudge against the urban Kurds. The trouble is stirred by those coming up from the regions. There are no jobs out there, and they come looking for jobs in Osh, especially at the bazaar market. Young people come on buses on the morning and work the whole day at the market, and many of them drink in the evening and then pick a fight. We are relatives and friends with the local city Kurds. I always explain the need to work with the regional youth, but no one is paying attention to us. So that's a couple of reasons why we would question, a couple of grounds to question some of these initiatives based on that they're misdiagnosing the conflicts, causes of conflicts, and also how they recruit mediators. The big question for me is, how do you evaluate the programs that have been funded? Because it could be that these criticisms that people have voiced to us are misplaced. It's not necessarily mutually exclusive to blame elites, but also to be the case that the non-elites join in racist violence. Some people spoke positively of these programs, but it's hard to evaluate the success. And so what I want to do is think of four claims for success and how we might evaluate them. Four examples. And the first is that I asked a major international donor in Osh to try and persuade me of the success of his projects. And he cited a 2011-12 project which worked with 120 students from Osh and Jalalabad University in summer camps. And they were organised through a local partner, Fund for Tolerance International. And they were funded by the UK's Department for International Development. The students were given tolerance training and project cycle management, which he explained is identifying and developing a good idea from the start into a formal proposal and then managing a budget and implementing it. The original intention was that these would be ethnically mixed, but Uzbeks eventually made up less than 10% of these projects because they were afraid to participate because of ongoing violence. 14 projects were funded. One of them made posters put up in buses urging people to be tolerant, he said, and another saw students going into schools and doing workshops with the children on tolerance. These came to an end in April 2012 because, unfortunately, we couldn't extend them as we had hoped. There were funding problems. The organisation head said to me, this worked very well. It was not ambitious. It needed limited resources, and we exceeded our objectives. Small things often work well. Now, what this means, apparently, is that a certain number of people were trained in tolerance, and they properly demonstrated an ability to undertake project cycle management on a tolerance-related thing. We don't know whether these individuals were already tolerant, whether they became more or less so as a result of these projects, or what impact their projects had. We simply know that a certain amount of money, British government money, was spent by a London-based NGO and a professional local NGO in training on a certain number of students in a certain time. And this is how that was success. A second example was adduced by the representative of an international organisation, again in answer to my question about evidence of success. And he spoke about so-called anti-terror operations in Nariman, an Uzbek village on the edge of Osh, in July 2010. And he said this, he said, folk in Ally, these are the monoethnic Kurdish regions that our previous respondents referred to, folk in Ally come together for a celebration. And rumours reached them that the Uzbeks in Osh had started another war. Our mediators, who knew each other by then and had personal contact details, called each other and were able to clarify what was happening and to defuse tensions. After calling folk in Nariman, the Ally mediators went into the streets of Ally and used phones to convey to people the truth. I want to get teams from different districts to go to each other's regions to make future contacts, so that future conflicts like Ally versus Osh Mahallas become less likely. Now, we lack sufficient evidence to evaluate this claim. The logic of the argument appears reasonable, but who knows whether a further outbreak of violence would have occurred or not in the absence of these exchanges. Such networks and links can hardly be bad, but would they have been enough to defuse and de-escalate the tensions that occurred in June 2010 or in future ones? We don't know. We don't know. These activities can open new ways to refute rumours and to crisis. They may be able to make a contribution to preventing further violence. It's difficult to tell on the evidence that we have at the moment. This leads to a third example, which I mentioned briefly, the example of Busguen. Busguen was the town in 1990 where the previous incident of mass violence between the Kurds and Uzbeks had begun. And as I said, international donors claimed that it didn't occur in 2010 because mediators had been trained in the past, stepped forward and calmed the situation. Again, we don't know whether these are sort of people, because people trained as mediators are generally already community leaders, would they have done this anyway if this really happened? So at the moment, I'm undertaking some research with some local colleagues to try and look in detail at what actually happened in Uzbekistan at that time without that sort of research. And it's the type of research that these organisations came up to do. We don't really know whether these were successful. But the fourth example, and the final one I want to think about, is that simply having someone listed as a trained mediator is no guarantee that they are having the desired impact, so even that they share the same ideological presuppositions with donors. So again, I asked one of the donors, introduce me to someone who you would regard as a successfully trained mediator. So he introduced me, and I spent a long time speaking to this woman. She'd gone through OSC community mediating training programs. And according to her own claim, she'd been very successful. She first of all trained 22 people and then trained 40 more. What is required by the donors is that they train individuals who then go on and train other individuals and so on. So it has a ripple effect. These figures no doubt feed into the donor reports of success. But the actual impact cannot be discerned from figures alone. Interestingly, for her, being trained gave her greater social capacity and authority. As a result of training, she said, she gained confidence and more social esteem. She was elected as the head of her block of flats. But tellingly, she recounted that she, although previously she was the sort of person who would go and help people sort out their difficulties, the training, she said, gave me great additional benefit in that it gave me documents and certificates. Before, I didn't have these documents, but now I have an excuse to go somewhere. I say I have a reason to come here, and people can't tell me it's none of my business. We are mediators, I say. We've been given authority to go into a conflict situation and call the people to be living unity so we can protect Kurdistan's integrity, to live well, not to quarrel. And she summarised the training that she gave the second group of people. As we got to know each other, we got to explain to the ordinary people, to parents, to teachers, calling on them to live in concordance, saying we needed to be together to protect the unity of the people. Now, the word she's using, unity, is Burundi, and concordance is Intimak and Kyrgyz. They have a particular place in contemporary Kyrgyz national understandings. Contemporary Kyrgyz political ideology draws on an idea of the nomadic past, but the great in inner Asian tribal confederations, those that survive were those that could create unity between different tribes. And the great Kyrgyz leader Manas, who is the main symbol of independence in Kyrgyzstan, is held as the leader of these. Now, she was using terms that derive from a Kyrgyz nationalist imaginary and using them in a very different way that the mediators, the OSC, were using them. So, for example, during the court, she was actually a member of a local political party, of a nationalist political party. She was a keen supporter of a chap called Melis Mirzad Martov, who was the mayor of Osh at the time, and was regarded as something as a firebrand nationalist. During the course of our interview, she espoused numerous anti-Uzbek prejudices, that Uzbeks themselves burned their houses down to make the Kurds look bad, that Uzbeks started the conflict in order to break up Kurdistan, that they gained financially by monopolising international aid, that their leaders have orchestrated a concerted campaign in international media on the internet to blacken the honour of the Kurds. She regards the police mistreatment of Uzbeks as revenge for what they did to us trying to take our country. And she insisted that although Uzbeks began, it wasn't the ordinary people, it was their leaders. therefore demonstrating that blaming leaders is not necessarily an alternative to being racist. Now, how can we evaluate this? We shouldn't judge this woman too harshly. It's difficult for any of us to transcend the interests and prejudices of our social group. Few of us can do that completely. We shouldn't expect a necessarily trained community mediator to do that. And it may be that the experience of taking part in these mediation and training programs will soften her attitude to us vets, and that she'll imbibe some notions of tolerance. On the other hand, it might be that international donors have equipped someone who will use her newfound social and political capital to propagate a nationalist vision of peacemaking and mediation as basically signing up to the ethnic Kyrgyzs of the state. And it is this nationalist vision, not a liberal OSCE one, that she is imparting and reinforcing in her new generation of community mediators. The international donors have no way of knowing, whatever the case, she and her 60-plus mediators appear in someone's spreadsheet as evidence of the success of promoting tolerance or mediation knowledge. But it's far from certain that this claim can be justified. The opposite may be the case. Now, staging reconciliation events in Osh, I think, can have a powerful symbolic value. And it raises critical questions about the future of humanity looking beyond the world of nation states. And it may be that some individuals who've taken part in these seminars will go on to be great future peacemakers in Kyrgyzstan. However, we can't find any compelling evidence that the mediation, reconciliation, and peacemaking activities led by international donors are useful in conflict management, and there are many reasons to suspect that they may even be counterproductive. And so to finish, I want to give a few summaries and policy recommendations. The summary is that Western donors that supported peacemaking and mediation and reconciliation drives initiated in response to the violence of 2010. These are proliferated because they are short-term, they are low-budget, they are easy to initiate through the use of existing partners, they bypass the local state and thus minimise bureaucracy, and they make great promises and offer statistical claims to success. It's difficult to evaluate, in part because of the nature. How could we measure whether a resource such as intercommunal trust has been increased? How could we establish whether these people prevent future conflict is difficult to do? Therefore, I wouldn't positively conclude that these projects lack value. However, critical questions can be raised about them. Limited research on similar projects in Central Asia has found that they generally misdiagnose the causes of conflict, and aid generally has unintended political consequences. A number of recommendations. Some particular recommendations for those working with peace building and mediation and reconciliation projects. Find ways to prioritise working with the demographic groups directly involved in perpetrating violence. Rather than divorcing development from peace building, conflict mediation and reconciliation should be aimed at young men and go hand in hand with the substantive element of creating economic opportunities for them. Thirdly, it's necessary to develop more critically reflective and rigorous appraisal mechanisms of the effectiveness of these interventions. I think it might be useful to make long-term commitments to working with key individuals and communities. And I'll finish with a general recommendation. Because tensions have existed between Kyrgyz and Uzbeks and Osh for decades and will continue to exist. However, only on two occasions has this led to massive violence. One was in 1990, June 1990, and one was in 2010. And I think a common factor in both cases was political instability. In 1990, the Soviet Union was unraveling, and there was fears about the breakup of Kyrgyzstan, a power vacuum, and this violence occurred. Secondly, in 2010, there was a power vacuum. As Jeff mentioned, these events followed a revolution in Kyrgyzstan, the overthrow of the corrupt Bakiyev government, and a power vacuum. And again, fear about Kyrgyzstan's future. So in order to help prevent these conflicts, maybe what the outside can do is try and help prevent political instability, which is easier said than done. But it's alleged that one of the main sources of the Bakiyev clan's corrupt activities was the arrangement of subcontractors to supply fuel to the US air base in Manas. The air base was so lucrative that the Bakiyev clan, because of its opaque offshoring arrangements, which made siphoning off large sums of corruption easy. And it was the corruption of the Bakiyev regime that led to his unpopularity. Western, and particularly UK and US, offshoring arrangements continue to facilitate patterns of corruption in Kyrgyzstan. And this makes it more difficult to produce economic and social development that would contribute to stability. There are several areas where EU states, particularly the UK and the US in particular, could do more to tackle our own culpability in creating conditions for corruption and therefore social discontent. We need to work harder to improve anti-money laundering regime, which will make corruption less possible, and the corruption obviously which fuels political crisis. A Global Witness report in 2012 on Kyrgyzstan recommended that, which uncovered numerous instances of really quite insidious corruption, where money was siphoned through non-existent companies or dead individuals registered in UK and US territories, recommends that the UK and US require that the identities of real beneficial owners of all companies should be publicly available in the country they are incorporated, and nominee directors and shareholders should be liable for their clients' actions. The largest, the most expensive ever legal case in UK courts was the Tajikistan case about control of resources connected to aluminium smelting plant, for example. Western states should do much more to facilitate the recovery of stolen assets and tackle tax evasion for our own corporate and financial systems. So I suppose I started by asking what Western states can do to mediate conflict in Kyrgyzstan. It might be that conflict prevention actually begins at home. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. I think it's a good segue entering ending on the question of how political instability and corruption led to conflict, which I think takes us very neatly into Ukraine. So, Tina, the floor is yours.
Okay, so thanks so much. I was just listening to these conclusions and was thinking how much they are in tune with what I wanted to raise today, although the situation is quite different. As we are talking now, I was just thinking that a couple of days from now, we may be again in a different situation as the military buildup on the Ukrainian border continues, and you could read reports from the OSCE, you could hear the statements at the UN Security Council on Ukraine, number 26, I think these days, about the Minsk agreement not respected. Russia continue in its military build-up. The separatists trying to capture even more territories. So it's not about reconciliation and peace building in Ukraine's case, unfortunately. The key point for us is to see if there is any way to stop the military buildup and actually stop the fighting. Without that, naturally, there is little we could discuss right now. So a little bit of the context of where we are. Jeff mentioned at the beginning that we've got something like over 500,000 IDPs, so the people who are displaced in Lugansk and Donetsk region. Something like 4,000 lives lost, military as well as civilians, about 1,700 civilians are reported missing, about 600 military people, but also a few civilians as well, are held as hostages, and hostage trading is a very, I would say, kind of a business for the separatists. The substantial proportion of Donetsk and Lugansk is being held by the separatists. Well, Ukraine no longer controls 7% of its territory, of which about 3% is in Donetsk and Lugansk, and then, another 4 is Crimea, but Crimea is a different story, so we'll talk about Donetsk and Lugansk now. If you go there to the territories which are we call them liberated or conditionally liberated territories, which are still now controlled by the Ukrainian government. It's also not all absolutely fine and okay and certain there. So the situation is very volatile. It can change every minute. And the dominant feeling of the people on these territories is fear, naturally. So they fear anybody carrying weapons. They fear the separatists to return. They fear Ukrainian armed forces. They fear shelling. They fear the best, the worst scenarios. They don't trust anybody, and they have very little hope and very little respect for the Ukrainian government's initiatives, of which they may hear. Respect for property, for human rights, for human dignity, for human rights is really very, very low. And I'm speaking now about the territories which are controlled by the Ukrainian government. What is happening in the territories which are not controlled by the Ukrainian government? We can only speculate. We do not have people with whom we work directly in those territories, because all of those NGOs, civic activists, journalists, that the International Renaissance Foundation, which is part of the OSF, has been supporting there for years, because all of them are no longer there, because for them it would be really a life-threatening situation. We still do have some reports from people who make their way to those territories, and these reports, unfortunately, do not create very, very good expectations. How all that happened. I was thinking about similarities with the Kyrgyz situation, and in fact there are many similarities. Though, as I mentioned, it's not an ethnic conflict, it's not about ethnicity, it's not about land, it's not about which of the ethnic groups is superior to the other and which is subordinate. It's rather a clash of very distinct ideological identities. So you would say, we would say, it's a clash between Soviet mentality and post-Soviet mentality and expectations. It's a clash between different historic myths and grievances and perceptions. It's not limited to support for Maidan and anti-Maidan. I would say it's broader than that, and it started before the Maidan. Historically, and when I say historically, I do mean like most of the 20th century at least, there have been different historic heroes and different perceptions of what is glory and what is the opposite in the people living in the east of Ukraine and many people living in the west of Ukraine. But that didn't actually lead to fighting before. I mean, they could have different perceptions. They could have think that Donbass was feeding the entire Ukraine, and that was a special kind of people with a special kind of virtues, but that indeed didn't lead to violence and to clashes. So what happened in the beginning of this year, when after Maidan, Russia invaded the Crimea, and Ukraine had no strength to resist and to protect its territory. It appears to too many politicians and other local vested interests that capturing the Donbass would be as easy as, well, I would say bloodless, as it happened in the Crimea. But then the situation went out of control. So what we are having is a combination of a succession of corrupt, non-democratic governments at the national level, at the regional level, vested interests of very irresponsible politicians who are always happy to play the regional grievances and regional prejudices, and also a lot of propaganda. So you might watch it in the media, you could see Russia today of all sorts of stories being pulled about Ukrainian fascists and so on. You can blame it on propaganda to a certain extent, though, because I cannot really see too many victims of this propaganda. What we see is too many people who were prepared to listen to the news, portraying Ukraine in a very bad light and believing it. And, well, so what we have today is, as I mentioned, as can be described as a clash of identities. And this is not just limited to the situation which is now held by the separatists. So for the purpose of discussing what we could do, I would suggest we talk about those territories and those people who are on Ukraine-controlled territories. This can be people from Donetsk and Lugansk regions and areas which are held by the separatists. This can be local people in the rest of Donetsk and Lugansk. But what we see is that tensions continue. They are not resolved, and those people who are on Ukraine-held territories are not necessarily absolutely positive of what they are getting and how they can continue and how they can rebuild a normal life in those territories. Partly it's because the government has been not fast enough in reacting to the problems and the grievances of the as well as of the local population, because the resources are scarce. The winter is coming, there's no housing, there are no jobs. The people really feel anxious, and they do not really get from the government the answers of what is being done, what will be done, what they can expect. So that adds to the problems. There have been efforts from the international community to deliver humanitarian assistance to prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in the region. Well, these efforts are at the very beginning. It's difficult to estimate, to evaluate them now, because they're just starting to build their presence, starting to plan. What I can say on a positive note is that the donors are aware of the problems of not coordinating well enough at the early stage, and they are also aware that no quick fixes will probably work. This, unfortunately, is the situation for many years, and it will require a long-lasting commitment and a major financial commitment of whoever chooses to participate in the peace-building process and also the reconstruction and recovery of the territory. Civil society, well, we work with civil society, and we're sure that civil society has a critical role to play. So civil society has stepped in when the government was so slow. By the way, we still do not have a law on the status of internal displaced persons and on how the government will react and will accommodate them and so on. We have bits and pieces of regulations. We still do not have a consolidated budget to address the needs of IDPs and also the territories to which people return. But anyway, so I mentioned the civil society. Civil society and volunteers have done a lot to help the displaced people, try to make sure that the grievances between the host communities and the displaced people do not go very deep, because we already are having some worrying trends where the scarcity of resources and these new arrivals have less than nice and peaceful and tolerant relations with the host populations. But civil society cannot carry on the entire work itself, of course. One of the points here, which I think is very important, is that civil society, it's not just donor-funded or donor-supported NGOs, which do their work well professionally in a systemic way. We are seeing a very interesting phenomenon in Ukraine after Maidan, which is the emergence of the grassroots non-organized or non-institutionalized civil initiatives, which self-organized themselves after the Maidan or during the Maidan, which now try to show solidarity, try to fill in the gaps where the local government is not functioning, where the national government is not functioning. So this is, I think, a very important area where a lot of effort is still needed, but a lot of hope still exists. And I think the hope would be materialized if the civil society does not just include volunteers who help others, including the IDPs. Just to give you an example where I think it's important, a few weeks ago we organized a call for proposal for volunteer initiatives, including those helping the IDPs from the conflict affected areas. We got something like 120 proposals, only 3 or 4 of them came from the IDP groups themselves. What I think is important is really see how we could engage these people, not just in participatory assessments of what they need, but also in doing something for themselves, working directly with international donors and with the government on early recovery, regeneration, livelihoods, ensuring that there is transparent division or distribution of humanitarian aid, ensuring that there are local democracy tools in place, there is no corruption, and there is one fundamental thing which all these regions and areas really need. I mentioned earlier there is little trust for property and human rights and human rights and everything. Human security and human safety remains a huge concern. How to engage the local population, IDPs and the host communities as well, in providing for security, i.e. protecting themselves? This is a big question and a very important one. There is another one where I think our attention should lie, and this is about addressing the problem of underprivileged younger, angry, and active people who that having a gun really can serve as a social lift which they were not having otherwise. For many of those younger people in the economically destroyed region of Donetsk and Lugansk, having weapons would be looking like a solution to a lot of many problems. So local disarmament, transformation of the conflict and preventing it from re-escalation, that would also be an important part. So just to wrap up with a couple more things. Nicholas mentioned about having a donor-supported peace-building efforts, which did a lot of good things, but didn't really address many of target groups, the main, let's say, risk groups or perpetrators or potential perpetrators of conflict. This is also one of the issues we are now thinking of. We work directly with civil society groups which try to serve as facilitators of dialogue, as mediators or transformers of the conflicts in communities, but the weakness we are seeing so far is that the predominant majority of those, the interlocutors in this dialogue, are the people who are prepared to talk, are the people who were not really the troublemakers, who were not perpetrating the conflict, whereas many others who need to be reached out to somehow are not engaged in this violence yet. So how to do that? To be honest, we do not know right now. And if you have some advice on that, we would really appreciate it. The necessary further steps, which I think would be important and it's in part related to what I was mentioning before on regeneration and early generation and rebuilding efforts and engaging people in helping themselves. People need to be given practical things to do. If we just go there with a round table or a seminar on how to be friendly to each other, we probably will not get a lot of attention, and we probably will not help a lot of in the situation. So we think that such seminars and such discussions could really should follow the practical work, and that practical work can be found in engaging people in reconstruction, in coming together around the local school, which they will first rebuild, paint, make sure the roof is there, and then use it as a local core place of peace and talking to each other. That probably would be a positive and good experience for the people. Reconciliation, it's not something which we can discuss right now. I mean, reconciliation doesn't happen when the fighting is still on. And as I said earlier, the fighting, unfortunately, will continue. So at this stage, we are talking about facilitating dialogues, making sure that people identify for themselves what they need and what they want. There is still not an agreement in many of these communities of what kind of future they want for themselves, where they see themselves, and what the next steps should be. Helping them have these dialogues, I think, would be a good entry point, at least for the immediate time. I do think that donors and the government and the civil society will need to address the root causes. The root causes of the problem are the same, and Nicholas mentioned them in his speech I mentioned them earlier. That's corruption, the lack of social lifts, the lack of hope for the population, unemployment, deprivation, economic devastation, you name it. There's nothing new in those things. And unless people see that these issues are being addressed, unfortunately, I do not think we will have peace and stability and good relationship, even in a country as relatively homogeneous in ethnic terms, for the which it is. I'm done.
Thank you very much, Nina. I was struck by what you said about the clash of historicalness. My colleague Michael Hall, who's joining us from New York, and I had the opportunity to visit Bosch about 2 months after the conflict. And I think one of the things that struck us both was the extent to which the two communities had developed absolutely different narratives about what had happened, what had caused the violence, who had been responsible. Assuming the same thing is true in Ukraine, and that this actually is going to complicate the efforts of putting it back together again, because on top of the historicness, you then have the question of different narratives and blame casting about the events itself. But before we open to questions, I wanted to push you, because your presentation focused on those parts of the Donbas that are still controlled by the Ukrainian government. But that leaves out somewhere in the vicinity of, 3 million people who are at least theoretically citizens of your country. The government in Kiev has recently said that, in essence, they're going to abandon these people to their fate. And while, just to be a little provocative, certainly you can understand the idea that why should we pay if we don't control it? Or turning to Russia and saying, essentially, as we do in the United States, you broke it, you bought it. But nevertheless, in terms of long-term reconciliation of the country, unless there's no hope of reconciling this part, how does this decision of the Ukrainian government to essentially leave this part of the country to its own devices play into long-term reconciliation dynamics?
Well, it's actually a very painful question, which has been discussed quite a lot in Ukraine, and there is put a simple answer to this. I can give my personal view on it, and I'm lucky I'm not in the Ukrainian government, because In my view, the government, in a way, is using this as a bargaining chip. It wants to put pressure on the region's authorities. It also wants to put pressure on the other interlocutors. Basically, what it says is we are not paying pensions, we are not paying salaries, we are not taking any responsibility for the separatist held territories. You could see that this is actually quite a big difference from what was initially in this recently adopted law on the special arrangement for the region, the separatist held region of the Donbass, which followed the Minsk agreement and which basically was a possibility for the government to have to leave some hope and leave some way for, if not for reconciliation and peace, then for at least some continuing dialogue with the authorities of the region, which could be elected. You know, the elections were supposed to take place on the 7th of December under the Ukrainian law, and they were theoretically designed to produce a legitimate local government, which would then be able to be entitled to transfers from the national budget for the needs which the local government itself would identify. So there was a very, I would say, welcoming arrangement, which was badly criticized in Ukraine, I have to say, exactly because of this. Why do we pay them if we do not control that? But now, after the separate held territories had their own elections on the 2nd of November, and the Russian Federation already said these were the legitimate people to represent the territories, I think for the Ukrainian government, little is left in except trying to use this tool of budget support to convince that the local elections still need to happen, and they need to happen in accordance with the Ukrainian legislation, and that the whatever happened in the beginning of November, that was not elections, and whatever, whoever was elected, that's not a legitimate representative in accordance to the education. If you look at the issue and say whether it is productive for future peace building and whether it will build or create additional grievances, I do not know to what extent it will, let's say, raise the level of dissatisfaction with the national government. It's, in my view, a very dangerous decision because it does leave behind a lot of Ukrainian citizens who are in no possibility to leave the areas. They cannot relocate for all sorts of reasons. They can be sick, elderly, having no jobs, having no housing, so on and so forth. In a way, I would say that the government has chosen a very risky way, and this definitely does not add to reconciliation. But looking at what are the ways of doing, what well, handling the situation they have, I don't know.
Thank you, Ina. So we have about 20 minutes for questions. Just for logistical ease, I'd like to ask, does anyone in New York want to start off with a question?
Yes, actually. So thanks, Jeff, for the opportunity. Thanks, Nick and Ina, both of you, for your presentations. Nick, a question to you. You know, Jeff is quite right when he mentioned one of the things that really struck us back in 2010 when we were both in OSH was the divergence in the narratives among the two communities about what happened, how it happened, and who was ultimately responsible, what the root causes were, and so on. And this is something that remains true even now four years on. And obviously the memories are still very painful and sensitive and on all levels. There's, of course, one could point to the recent case of the NGO in Osh that attempted to show a film about victims of sexual violence, mostly ethnic Uzbeks in Osh, and the trouble that got them into. And I'm wondering, I mean, is it worth, are there ways that one could try to address this issue? This goes somewhat beyond the scope of your report, but I'm wondering, as someone who has spent as much time in Osh as you have, Would you see value, would you see utility in something like a truth commission, and something that would allow a sort of an open kind of airing of grievances, a sort of a national debate? Is this something even possible to consider in Kyrgyzstan right now, or is this completely just crazy? Secondly, speaking as a donor, I take on a lot of the criticisms that you've raised, and these are issues that we grapple with as well. One argument, that one idea at least that we've had, is that really it may not make sense to do specific targeted trainings of the kind that you're talking about, but what's really needed is to engage through, for instance, the education system and raise critical thinking skills, for instance, in general, as kind of a panacea for these sorts of issues. That the idea being that people are more, that students from a very early age are trained and encouraged in greater degrees of critical thinking and debate, that this might make them somehow less susceptible to provocations, less susceptible to manipulations by political entrepreneurs of various stripes. And I'm wondering if in your work, if this was an issue that you looked at, that you came across, the way in which education, the way in which support for critical thinking and debate and education might be something that may have an ameliorative or preventative effect when it comes to conflict. There's a lot more I could ask, but maybe I'll stop there for now. And it'd be great to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you. And your second point, yeah, as a teacher, as a lecturer, I can only agree that teaching the kids to think critically differently is good. The main point about two very different narratives is a very good one. One of the things I've done in Osh is I've lived between, over the time I've been there, between Kyrgyz and Uzbek communities, and you can tell two very different stories about Osh as a disputed space. I'm a geographer, and we're interested in how places become imbued with meaning and how we struggle for places. So if you can tell an Uzbek story, that historically the Uzbeks lived in the towns and the cities in the towns in southern Kyrgyzstan, that they had the mosques and they built, they were artisans and traders and craftsmen. And then over time, Kyrgyz migrants, former nomads, moved into the city and took it over. In the Soviet times, the Soviets wanted to create a Kyrgyz-speaking elite, so it wasn't seen that they were a foreign power. That over time, Kyrgyz were given political authority, political power. With independence, they moved in large numbers. They've pushed Uzbeks out of the bazaars. They've pushed them out of politics. And the violence of 2010 can be seen simply as as more of the same. Violence against us. This is a Kyrgyz takeover of our town. But from a Kyrgyz perspective, you can tell a parallel story. Historically, the Kyrgyz would say, as nomads, they didn't reside in a particular place, but it didn't mean that their ancestors didn't own it, or there wasn't their land. Over time, the Uzbeks took Kyrgyz land. They lived in the cities. And so when the Kyrgyz moved into to study at universities and to take positions in banks and government, they found they were unwelcome. The best land, the best homes, the best recreational spaces were owned by the Uzbeks. You read the biographies of many Kyrgyz politicians, that they had to reside, they would say, in when they were students in Osh. This is what there's a master there in Osh, had to reside as a paying tenant to Uzbeks. We were looked down on. Many Kyrgyz would say when they first came to the city that Uzbeks would look down on them. They're just dirty nomads, they don't have any civilization. And the Uzbeks are speaking their own language rather than Kyrgyz. At the time of independence, there was only one Kyrgyz speaking school in Osh. The rest were Uzbek and Russian. So Kyrgyz families had to send their children to schools in which their children couldn't do well at because they couldn't speak the language they were looked down on. And so you can tell this story from a Kyrgyz perspective. This is our land, our town, and the Uzbeks are trying to take it over in 2010, seeing for them as a moment of separatism. This was an attempt by Uzbeks to seize this land from us and have it to Uzbekistan. So you have got these two very different narratives, very different narratives. What can you do about them? I don't think a sort of South Africa-style truth committee use of the moment in South Africa, it worked because one side had clearly won. In Kyrgyzstan, the tensions are still too great. I think something like that would lead to great more violence. But there is a third set of narratives that can be told by people who live in Osh. And this is a narrative of Kyrgyz and Uzbeks as sharing space. When President Bakiyev was overthrown, visited Tashkent in 2006 to meet his Uzbek counterpart, he gave a speech saying that the Uzbeks and the Kyrgyz are one. He switched to speaking Uzbek because being a southern Kyrgyz, he could speak Uzbek. He delighted his hosts, saying, "We share our bazaars and our mazars, which are our cemeteries. We drink the same water, we breathe the same air, we give daughters in marriage, we take daughters in marriage, we share a language, and we share faith." This can be very important discourse, the Soviet discourse of the friendship of the peoples. In Osh, many of the Kyrgyz and Uzbeks who lived in Osh and were born there grew up. Possibly they were in a Russian-speaking school and Russian-speaking classes in university. There were Russians and Kyrgyz and Uzbeks and Armenians and Tatars and everyone else who was there. And they have a strong sense of being what the Kyrgyz would call themselves, a Shaltal Kyrgyz, an urban Kyrgyz. I'm not like those people who live in the mountains. So there is this strong narrative that can be told of Osh as shared space. And so my hope is that it is very easy, as we've heard in Ukraine, for example, it's very easy for ethnic entrepreneurs to peddle the stories of difference and conflict. And those can be told, and there's some basis to them. But what I would hope is for a generation of new politicians who can turn those other stories, those parallel stories of cooperation, who can translate those into more of a political program. So I think the hope for Osh isn't in what outsiders do or doesn't do. It's in the vision of local politicians and local leaders.
Can I just push a little bit on that? Because in your presentation, you had said the problem isn't the people living in Osh, it's the people from rural areas surrounding Osh who don't participate in this narrative. So how does that, wouldn't that make it difficult to...
I think that's a new challenge. How do you teach this story? The people who come in, rural Kyrgyz who migrated into Osh, they've not grown up with Uzbeks. The Kyrgyz in Osh grew up hearing Uzbek music in the streets and speaking Uzbek with their friends. Rural Kyrgyz don't have that background, don't have that history. And that's the challenge, I think, to how to incorporate them. I don't know how you can do that. It needs to be done, otherwise we're just going to be essentially an ethnocracy in Osh.
So let me open the room to questions. Again, if you're at the table, please just speak up. If you're at the back room, my colleagues are looking at the microphone. Please, please.
I'm Nellie Orr of Pleasants Experts Network. I recently watched a movie. It was actually a Kazakh movie, but I think a lot of the phenomena seen there correlate to what I've seen in my study of Kyrgyzstan. It's called Harmony Lessons, and about some boys in a school where they're taught great things about harmony and about mankind and ideals of peace. But then the everyday life of the school is that it's in the grip of young thugs who shake down the kids for the benefit of the criminals in prison and make the lives of these kids intolerable. And certainly, my understanding of Kyrgyzstan is that the crime, organized crime groups are powerful. They form those self-defense organizations that are attempt to keep the peace for the benefit of certain people, and that some of the 2010 violence was certainly exacerbated, if not initiated, by the weapons that were brought in by various groups. And so, what can be done about that?
I don't know. You're right. What can you do? What do you think?
If there were non-corrupt government officials who would actually prosecute them, it's just a vicious cycle.
I'm Janice Howard with the U.S. Helsinki Commission, and I have two questions, one on Kyrgyzstan and one on Ukraine, both OSCE-oriented. The first one on Kyrgyzstan. You've talked a bit about evaluations that you've done of programs going on in the country, including by the OSCE. And I wonder, do you present your results back to the organizations, or do we need to somehow look at developing a mechanism for that? Because I think that kind of feedback would be really good. And I'm praying. Two questions. The first is, you were mentioning the importance of dialogue, and I wondered if you were at all familiar with the OSCE's National Dialogue Project that went on in the spring. I think it kind of stopped a bit over the summer and maybe getting going again, and if you think that that is or was valuable or would be valuable. And also, if you had any comments on the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission and its work, particularly in Eastern Ukraine. Thanks.
And your first question, my purpose in writing these types of reports is if people can see them. I think that it would be very interesting to work with a donor in advance. So when a project is planned, to actually plan into that a long-term deeper evaluation, maybe working with groups of academics and researchers and giving access from the start, that would be really interesting thing to do. To think about in the future.
Ina, do you want to handle the Ukraine questions, please?
Yes. So thanks. First, on the national dialogue by the OSCE. Well, it was a useful format. It's, I think, had its limitations, like any big level, national, whatever ambitious dialogues have. There are always people who feel they have not been included. It's not possible to include everybody who has a say, and you obviously find somebody who really felt that his or her voice was not heard. That's why when we speak about dialogues, we would not look at this big and formal events with pre-selected participants who then are supposed to sort of represent some group, but the problem is that very often they do not, and there is no this connection between what happened around the table at the national dialogue and what happens down there in the communities and groups. And the whole point of having inclusive dialogues is to have them, let's say, in a way where they can engage the people who are here and now in a specific territory, addressing a specific issue in which they can participate and in which they can make a difference for themselves. This is probably something which the high-level dialogues are not designed to achieve, because they are political tools. We were thinking about the practical things, and dialogue as part of understanding between people, confidence building, and basically a beginning of some kind of joint work, because we only think that joint efforts and ability to listen to each other and try to find a compromise, this is something which people would need, and they will not get it through just reading in the paper that there was a national dialogue in which some elected leaders or some appointed officials participated. On the special monitoring mission, I think they are trying to do their best. Just a couple of days ago, we were reading comments from people from the Special Monitoring Mission about how difficult it is for them to work in Donbas, in Donetsk and Lugansk. Just take an example of the border control. You know, Ukraine and Russia have 400 kilometers of border, and the OSCE controls about 1 kilometer and 2 checkpoints. So the ability of the Special Monitoring Mission is really limited. They do have access to the separatist held territories, but we were reading complaints about they really do not have the freedom of movement there. They can only be taken where the separatists want to take them. And that, by the way, does cause anxiety among the many of Ukrainians working on this conflict. Many of people, or a number of people in the government-held territories of Donetsk and Lugansk, So to just answer your question in a short way, the special monitoring mission is trying to talk to all sides and be this very important interlocutor. But we should be realistic about what they can do. Yeah.
Other questions, please? Well, then, let me ask a question and basically draws on things that both of you have said. You know, you talked about the importance of trying to work on joint projects like schools where there's some common interest. Nick has given examples of where this sort of dialogue proved to be rather empty in Kyrgyzstan. So I'd just like to ask you to comment a little bit on sort of specifically what you have in mind. And in addition to that, you talked about the uncertainty because of the potential for renewed military action. So I wanted to ask how you go about trying to do this in the areas on the fringes of the conflict zone, knowing that this may become a conflict zone again soon. And Nick, for you, on Kyrgyzstan, Ina had mentioned this idea of having a gun being a enabler for disenfranchised young men. And I think we saw a very similar phenomenon in Osh. I remember distinctly coming down the main road from the mountains, and the destruction would be just along the road until you got to an Uzbek area. So my question is, it didn't look like these disenfranchised young men were doing this on their own. It looks like they were being organized and taken advantage of. So what are your thoughts on who the enablers were, and also how you attack this nexus of working with them maybe is not all the problem, because left to their own devices, they wouldn't have done this. Ina, please.
Okay, me first?
Please.
Okay, yeah. So if I understood the question correctly, and please correct me if I didn't. Because the situation is so volatile and uncertain, and because the fighting continues in the fringe areas, it might happen that whatever work you do now may prove not very useful because it may be bombed again or captured again. Is that right?
Yes.
I think that the critical thing here is to make sure that the local population does their best to make sure that the territory is not captured again. And indeed, we did have examples in Ukraine where the local population resisted really strongly, and they prevented the capture by the separatist forces. And actually, the separatist forces are backed with Russian arms, Russian troops. I'm thinking about Mariupol, for instance, which really resisted strongly. There was a massive mobilization of the people to protect themselves. So in the fringe areas, I think the important thing would be to encourage this grassroots self-reliance, which would make it extremely difficult for the separatists to just come there and establish their rule. It happens, by the way, now and then in all this border town, or border little border towns in Donetsk and Lugansk region. And we think that the more people do for themselves, the more they invest in rebuilding their local school or their local whatever it is, hospital or houses, the more they will be prepared to defend themselves and not let them be captured again. So in a way, it's regeneration, livelihood, community work, building the sense of sticking together, building the sense of solidarity and self-help, and actually keeping people busy, which is quite important in post-conflict situation, which helps people to really transform into this positive thinking about what they could do. If that is backed with resources, and if there is some government money coming in, or there is some international donor money coming in, people also will have possibility to earn their living. And again, this is a very additional thing, which I think is necessary for stabilizing the situation.
Thank you, Nina. Nick, any questions?
Thank you, obviously there's no, wars, violent conflicts don't have a single explanation, a single cause, and so the complicated factors come together and a spark sets them off. And in Kurdistan, in Osh, the violence after a while took on the form of those organised and coordinated, and I don't think it started out, I think you had it. Well, all different reports seem to agree there was a confrontation with individuals that quickly spread as rumours spread. Mobile phones make it very easy. So most people in Osh have got family out in the neighbourhoods. They heard about this and they moved in. What's interesting is then how do you stop? A guy called Paul Brass worked in India on Muslim Hindu communal riots in India, and he looked at cases where the theft of an idol from a temple, or an attack on a mosque, or a murder of a politician would lead to massive violence, and other places when it wouldn't. And he looked at the role of leaders and the authorities in stepping in quickly and preventing this escalation. What's interesting was that in Kyrgyzstan, there was no one to do that. The government was effectively, it was a power vacuum. There was no one who could do that. There was no one. Initially, it was not large, heavily armed groups of people attacking. It was mobs with a few shotguns. Police should have been able to stop that, and they didn't. And this is a major question. What is interesting as well, and it's a provocative thought, is that in Uzbekistan there was no violence against the Kurdish minority. What we can seem to see is that the president of Uzbekistan intervened very quickly, sealed off border areas, flooded the areas where Kyrgyz minority live, and made it very clear that any attacks by Uzbeks in retaliation would be treated severely. So I think this raises very difficult questions for communities of outsiders like ourselves who have promoted democratization. Ultimately, it was the pseudo-democracy of Kyrgyzstan, destabilized through corruption that was financed, that was allowed through Western money and offshoring, was unable to contain its violence, and the authoritarian regime of Uzbekistan was able to contain. And that raises some questions for us.
Yeah, although I would have to say, since more people were killed in Andijan than in Osh, it maybe indicates that it's not really, that authoritarian stability is not the answer, certainly.
Yeah. It's not a long-term answer, but nor is the pseudo-democracy the case.
I would argue that Kyrgyzstan was the lack of a functioning government that made it more of an issue. But thank you all for coming, and I hope you'll join me in thanking both Ina and Nick for coming and sharing their views with us.